today I'm talking with Charles Bass, who runs an organization called Donors Choose. I think a lot of you, some of you will have heard of this, the social media guys will have heard of this, and then the none of the affiliate marketing guys will have heard of it, and it's a pretty interesting concept. Charles, maybe you can take it away and tell us all about what you do.
Yeah, hey, well, just quickly, donorschoose.org is a website where public school teachers post classroom project requests, and then donors can come and choose the classroom project that they want to support. And not only do they get to pick where their money is going to go, but then they get to see the impact of their donation in the form of photographs, student thank you letters, a teacher results letter from the classroom that they chose to support. And it's a website which grew out of a high school in the Bronx where I was a history teacher for 5 years.
Now, you sound like you've been, like, pitching the venture capitalist your whole life. Like, how long have you practiced the elevator pitch?
I've been learning as I go. But definitely, we began in the spring of 2000, and for our first few years, we operated out of my classroom. My students were our staff members, and suffice to say, I did not even know what an elevator pitch was. In fact, I only wrote a business plan for the organization when I had to teach my students how to write a business plan, and I had no idea how to do that, and I kind of crammed the night before having to teach this lesson to my students, and that taught me how to write a business plan. I then imparted that knowledge to my students, hopefully successfully, and then only a few days later, I was like, all right, well, now I know what a business plan is. Maybe I ought to write one for this little experiment of a charity website growing out of my classroom.
So you're a history teacher. Like, what kind of history?
I taught American history and world history.
So you can tell me about the history of Australia, huh?
I might fail in that regard, but I did teach one course. I was given real sort of a creative liberty, and I taught one class on the non-African, non-Hispanic peoples of the Caribbean and South America, which might have been of interest to you. So, you know, the great many people of Indian descent in Trinidad and Guyana, and the Lebanese and Arab diaspora in Latin America, and so that was kind of a fun course.
There's actually a bunch of Arabs here in the DR. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, everywhere. I mean, if you think about it, if you think of Shakira, Salma Hayek, and Carlos Slim as kind of leaders in their respective fields and things, I think all three of them have Arab roots or Lebanese roots.
You know, there's actually a word in Spanish, ojalá. Have you heard that word?
Oh, for sure, and I know. I think we have the Moors to thank for that back in Spain, right?
Yeah, but isn't that a word that comes from Arabic originally?
Exactly, yeah.
Right. Yeah, you get these odd things, and we need to get back on the interview, but just one other interesting thing I've noticed here. There's a town in the middle of the Dominican Republic called Constanta. It's a town of, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30,000 people, and It's kind of well known for being coal. And the people there, they look a little bit more Asian. And it turned out that in something like the 30s, a big settlement came over from Japan and just settled there. And so
wow.
There's this, like, Asian mix, like, right in the middle of Dominican Caribbean stuff, which is pretty
cool. There you go.
Anyway. So you were a history teacher for how long?
For 5 years.
All right. What did you do before that?
I graduated from college and spent a year in Latin America. My primary goal was to learn Spanish so that when I was been teaching, if I had any students whose parents primarily spoke Spanish, I could still get those students in trouble by being able to talk to their parents in their own language.
And then Donors Choose came along. Can you maybe tell us how that started and what kind of hatched the idea?
Yeah, for sure. So it was my first year of teaching, and I found my colleagues and I having the same conversation over and over again in the teacher's lunchroom about books that we wanted our students to read, and art supplies we needed for an art project, and microscopes we needed for a science experiment, a field trip we knew would really bring the subject matter to life, and none of these ideas would go past the teacher's lunchroom because there was no source of funding. And we teachers would go into our own pockets to buy basic stuff like copy paper and pencils, but for the most part, we saw our kids going without the materials and experiences they needed to learn, and we teachers had a tough time innovating. So that was the repeated conversation which spawned DonorsChoose.org, because at the same time that my colleagues and I were griping about that state of affairs, I figured that there were people from all walks of life who wanted to help improve our public schools, but were just getting more and more skeptical about writing, you know, a $100 check to a big institution and not knowing how the heck their money was spent. And I figured if we could enable anybody to be a philanthropist, if we could create almost a philanthropic eBay where somebody with $10 could pick a project that really spoke to them and see exactly how their money was being spent and hear back from the people they chose to help, well then my colleagues and I would be able to get our students those books and take them on that field trip.
I did an interview with Sarah from Tomato Nation, and she said that one of the things that really motivated her community to fundraise for you was George Bush and the political situation.
That's right. I think she first engaged her readers with her website when they were the day after they were getting over Bush defeating Kerry in the 2004 election, and they wanted to do something that would sort of both express their anxiety, but also their resolve. And I think it was a class set of George Orwell's 1984, which they funded as community, both to express where they thought the world was headed and to do something good for people.
And so you started Donut Shoes, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
It would now be 9 years ago in the spring 2000 when I started Donut Shoes. Our first few years we were operating in my classroom with my students as our staff members. It was in 2003 that Oprah Winfrey did just a phenomenal story about our faith. I have, yeah. That story prompted the first inquiries from other parts of the country about DonorsChoose.org expanding. Until 2000 through 2004, our site was only open to public schools in New York City. So it was in 2004 that we began to expand to other states and other cities, and only 2 years ago that we opened our website to every public school in America.
How did it provide you?
It was, I believe, a piece by Jonathan Alter of Newsweek, who was the very first journalist to break the story of DonorsChoose.org. I cold called him during my lunch hour while teaching, and unlike all the other reporters, he did not hang up the phone on me. And we spent an hour on the phone, and he wrote a column saying that he thought one day DonorsChoose.org would change the face of philanthropy.
And so did your website crash when you went over?
Completely melted down. We did get back up in about an hour's time, which was a little quicker than some other sites. But that hour was just horrible, painful, thinking about all these people, all these would-be donors hitting our site and being unable to make donations and help kids in public school. That was a tough hour, but an exciting one, I guess, at the same time.
And can you talk about how much you brought in when they had it on Oprah?
Yeah, for sure. It was $250,000 in donations from citizen philanthropists that we took in just a few days following Oprah's profile of our kind of nascent philanthropy.
That's interesting. So that's an organization that then was really rather small, and we can actually get a monetary value on being on Oprah. So if in your case it was worth $250,000.
That's exactly. When you had a baseline of donations as small as we did, it's very easy to isolate the impact of a highlight like that from Oprah.
That's an interesting statistic. I wonder what it's worth for an actual business.
Yeah, I think some extremely large. Because of course the even greater value of Oprah's story was the national expansion that it got the ball rolling toward.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Can you talk about how big you are today, like annual revenues, things like that? Like how the financials work? I mean, I assume by now this is your full-time thing and you have a team and...
That's right. That's right. As for the last 4 years, I've been doing DonorsChoose.org full-time. I have 52 colleagues, and as of today, and actually any member of the public can see our impact up to today if you go to DonorsChoose.org/impact. If you went to that page, you'd see that more than $40 million has been contributed to classroom project requests on our site by about 160,000 citizen philanthropists all across the country and in a few other countries as well. And it's 115,000 teachers in public schools, overwhelmingly in low-income communities, who have posted project requests on our site, and 105,000 projects that have come to life through our site for 2.7 million students.
Hmm. And what's your annual turnover now?
So this school year, we're projecting at least $23 million in classroom project funding.
Oh, so your growth is totally exponential.
It is. It's pretty close to hockey stick if you do check out our growth curve.
Wow, congratulations. That's impressive.
Thank you. Thank you.
So now you're going to turn this into eBay and be retire off in your Caribbean island that you bought?
I'm still can only strive for what you've pulled off. But we're a public charity, so although we're a charity, we do have a business model for achieving sustainability, our equivalent to profitability, and that's based on the option that every donor has when they're supporting a classroom project to dedicate 18% of their gifts to DonorsChoose.org operating expenses. More than 90% of donors choose to dedicate 18% of their gifts toward our operating expenses, and operating income thus generated makes DonorsChoose.org more and more self-funding. And when we get to about $40 to $50 million a year in classroom project funding, donors' inclusion of that optional operating gift will cover 100% of our operating expenses, and as a company, if you will, we will have broken even. And of course, at that point, we won't be generating profit, but we'll have become that rare species of an entirely self-sustaining nonprofit organization.
There actually could be. I mean, that could turn into a business model. Like, I could see companies starting to do giving to the community and then be totally funded by that, because they actually do it as an upsell after the person's done a donation, right? Here's thanks for your money. Would you like to contribute a percentage to this? And it's therefore kind of like an upsell.
essentially, that's exactly right. It's an opt-out upsell, but it's very clear and easy to opt out. But only less than 10% of donors do that. And the lesson seems to be that if you're optional and transparent, then donors really want to help you out with your operating expenses.
Yeah, right. And you had a team of 53 people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. 52, that's right.
So you've gone from being a history teacher to running a pretty decent-sized team. Were you expecting that?
I was not at all expecting that. what's most kind of surprising and thrilling is not the size of the team, the caliber of the team. To give you just a couple of profiles of colleagues of mine, our CFO was the CFO of two public companies before joining our little charity. He's a early 50s Harvard MBA who most recently was the CFO of Audible, and he's the CFO and board member of that company, helped take them public, and was with them for 6 years, and then announced on the Audible quarterly earnings call that the CFO would be leaving to join this little charity that nobody had heard of. And our CTO was a rising star at Microsoft before joining our organization, and he's just incredible. He's a meta CTO, in the words of our board chairman. And one final example profile, our head of operations is a guy who got his mechanical engineering degrees from Caltech and MIT, did his master's thesis on lean manufacturing practices at Toyota, got his MBA from Wharton, did 18 years at AT&T, and is now applying the lean manufacturing practices of Toyota to the donors2.org operation.
Well, I'll be expecting you guys to go public soon anyway, even though I'm sure you're a 501c, right?
That's right. We are a charity.
Who owns the organization?
I guess the public owns the organization insofar as we're a public charity. The board of directors is the group that I report to, I think I'd have to point to the board of directors, who of course don't hold shares and don't have any financial equity, but they are the ultimate authority, and they exercise that authority in the best interests of the students and teachers we serve.
And so my understanding of the way the process works is someone reading this interview now can go to the site, they can make a donation, they can choose to support or not support you, and 9 out of 10 of them will. The money then comes in, you guys then buy what is needed and then ship that directly to the teacher. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, and I appreciate your knowing that up front. Although it's straightforward to compare donors2.org to eBay or to Craigslist, our back office operation is more akin, at least aspirationally, to that of Netflix or Amazon. You identified pillar number two of our operating model. Pillar number one is that we vet and validate each teacher's project request before posting it to the public site. Then, as you said, we fulfill the project for the teacher and don't give the teacher cash. And finally, we provide a platform for teachers to publish photographs of the project taking place. They publish an initial thank you note when the project's funded and then a results letter when the project is completed. And finally, we give them the means by which to mail in student thank you letters addressed to all donors who give $100 or more. So a donor giving only $1 to a project at donors2.org still gets a thank you note from a teacher addressed to them, a results letter, photographs of their project taking place, and a cost report showing how every dollar on the project was spent. And then donors who give $100 or more also get this physical package of student thank you letters.
Oh, really? I think I get $100 about 2 months ago, so I'll get something in that, will I?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Probably kind of three and a half months after the project has been fully funded.
And so the guy who gave a dollar, then he gets all that information sent to his email, right?
That's exactly right. The guy who gives a dollar gets all the feedback, which is digital, and that's actually everything, the photos, the teacher, thank you letter, everything except for the student thank you letters, which we thought would lose a lot if we digitized them. They're handwritten, there are collages, yarn, paint, etc. So we decided to keep that old school analog.
One thing, when I went through and analyzed some of the numbers of donations, I was comparing, because I think Sarah's excellent, like I love donating a lot of traffic, and they just like kick everybody's butt, including
that's right,
people.
That's right.
It's just astounding. That per average donation was $330. Per average donation was something like $178. And it made me feel a little bit like a loser, because I only gave $100. Like, how are your average donations when people lose it?
You were not a loser at all when you gave $100. That was actually 20 more than the average donation, which is $80. I think that Sarah Bunting's average donation size, and maybe even Fred Wilson, may be helped by some large gifts that in Sarah's case she got from HP and from, I think, even an anonymous donor or two. My guess is that the blog reader, a true consumer, blog reader of Sarah's average donation is probably $100.
Oh, okay. So actually, this is one of the things that came up in Sarah's interview. Maybe you can comment on it. She said that one of her, she has a big donor that gave a ton of money that's from Norway. And it's interesting that someone in Norway would be interested in U.S. public education. Do you see that sort of stuff a lot? I mean, that's maybe the sort of thing that happens with the internet.
Yeah, it's that Norwegian donor is is a little bit of an outlier, but that's not. I don't think much goes by that someone in another country takes a big interest in our site. And we're not even built very well for donations from outside the United States. But I think there is something just really appealing about the giving experience at donorschoose.org. It really is this one place where with a dollar or $10, you can find a project that really speaks to you. And there are 20,000 live classroom project requests on our site at any given moment. And that means that somebody can express a really personal area of interest and find projects that match that interest. So you could search the keyword horseback riding, and you'll find a number of projects centering on therapeutic horseback riding for disabled students. You could type in yoga and see a whole range of teachers who need yoga resources to teach their students yoga. And I think that ability to express a personal passion and find projects that matches that passion, and then to see exactly how your money is being spent and hear back from the people you helped in this really vivid, tangible way, that maybe kind of crosses borders. And so we are able to attract the occasional donation from people like this guy in Norway.
When I get my money, because I was at we met at the Fred's event in New York, and I was talking with one of the teachers there, and she was asking me about, well, what projects did you give money to? And I didn't know, because I just went on and gave $100 to Fred's project. But she got kind of upset about that, and like wanted me to be going in and picking out the right project. I didn't really know what to do. Like, what percentage of your people go on and just like give money, and what percentage actually go through and pick out projects?
What's interesting about the social media challenge is it's actually a challenge for us. The social media challenge attracts an incredible number of donors, but donors whose primary loyalty is to the blogger or the Twitterer who just asked them to go donate. And in those instances, many of those donors are just looking to maybe guess as quickly as they can, because they want to help out the blogger who asked them to. And as in your example, they're not necessarily picking an individual classroom project which really inspires them. That is definitely the minority scenario. It's a majority scenario in the social media challenge, but net, it's probably even a small proportion of our donors who are not picking an individual project. And so we actually have this challenge with the social media challenge where we have a tough time getting those donors to become ongoing donors.org contributors. They'll give again in a year when their favorite blogger asks them to, but in the interim, we have a tough time getting them to develop some loyalty toward our site or specifically toward the classroom project on our site.
I mean, that's a classic sales sort of issue. And one of the things that is interesting to me about what you're telling me is, because I've received the follow-up, and there was an online note from a teacher and some stuff that I get that my $100 up front.
Yeah.
But if you're sending out, like, if I'm going to get some kids' letters and stuff like that, like, you know, it's going to make me all, like, happy and stuff, I would imagine you doing that sort of thing is going to help build relationships with everyone, and therefore that would help explain exponential hobby stick type growth, or does it not?
I think we'd like to think that does explain our growth rate. It's just that social media challenge donors like yourself are especially tough to convert into ongoing donors. But let's see if those student thank you letters don't do the trick.
So now you're like making me feel guilty. Now I've got to come back.
Exactly. Sadly, it's not scalable to do an hour interview with each of these donors to try and guilt them into becoming ongoing donors.
But you would if you could.
Right.
So does this, I mean, where does this go for you? Is this your full-time thing that you're going to do for the next 30 years? Like, what are your intentions with what you're doing?
I mean, I'm having even more of a blast now than a few years ago. My learning curve is deeper. I'm just having an incredible time. There's nothing right now that I want to be doing that I'm not able to do at donorschoose.org. And I haven't thought much about what lies beyond, because there's so much more for us to do here. And as one thing that we alluded to earlier, this school year, a majority of donors.org's operating expenses will be covered by donors and inclusion of that optional operating gift. But we are still a good distance from break even, and that's one milestone I'm just really excited for us to hit.
So you mentioned that. Like, I mean, in when you were getting started and you weren't anywhere near break even, like, how did you fund it?
By still living with my parents after graduating college and then not having any rent to pay, and then being able to dedicate some of my teacher's salary to donorschoose.org and getting it off the ground. And then, of course, after a year or two of that, we had a number of funders. Goldman Sachs Foundation was one of the very first supporters. They made kind of an angel investment in our charity, which enabled us to move out of my classroom in the Bronx into a real one-room closet of an office and then to build a real website. And 2.5 years ago, a group of Silicon Valley leaders, the Omidyar Network, created by Pierre and Pam Omidyar of eBay fame, David and Angela Philo of Yahoo fame, Vinod Khosla, Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix, Fred Wilson, Brad Byrne at Union Square Ventures, they formed this group to provide us with what we referred to as a round of funding. It was charitable funding, but it was structured on some of the same principles as venture investment. These Silicon Valley leaders had two expectations of DonorsChoose.org, almost conditions of the funding. One was that we would go national and open our site to every public school in America. And the second was that we get to our break-even point. The gap between what our donors give to us through that optional operating gift, between that and our actual operating expenses, is covered by this this one-time infusion of operating capital from these Silicon Valley leaders.
Hmm. Is that what were you working towards break-even by that point, or did those guys were that later on to give you impetus to move toward it more quickly?
We were, from the get-go, from year one of DonorsChoose.org, we had this model of letting donors choose whether or not they wanted to support our operating expenses. But as an organization which was open only in a handful of cities and a handful of states until 2.5 years ago, we had no hope of achieving the scale necessary for break-even. When we went national, we now have the potential to see so many cluster projects funded that donors' inclusion of the optional operating gift does cover all of our operating expenses, and we're on a pretty clear path to break-even. Mm.
And will you go international?
We actually have a board meeting, a board retreat this February, where we're going to think about all the expansion possibilities, which range from expanding to private schools as well as public schools, to expanding the model itself so that teachers could request volunteer needs as well as cash needs, to expanding the program to other verticals or other sectors within the United States, such as social workers or police officers, to expanding model to schools in other countries. So there are just a huge range of possibilities. Our strategy thus far, and my guess is our strategy for at least the next year, is to remain laser-focused on proving our core program of serving public school kids in the United States, namely those from low-income families, and that we would not look to extend the model until break-even was around the corner, if we choose even to extend the model. So thus far, I think for the next year, we're erring on the side of focus and really nailing it before we look further afield.
I guess that's an interesting issue, because you really have there's a lot in common with a startup and the way you've grown things. And so once you do get to that break-even point, like then you go to expansion, but then you're not expanding based around monetary goals, you're expanding based around human or like social goals. And
that's right.
It could be very easy for you to become folks.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So I guess having, if you've got guys like the Silicon Valley guys you mentioned advising you, they're probably not going to let you do that too easily.
That's exactly right. I have both incredible board members as well as incredible colleagues. Our board is really fun. Fred Wilson is on our board, whom you know, and just to give you a flavor for some of the other folks, Stephen Colbert of the Colbert Report, and Bill Bradley, the former senator and presidential candidate, Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn, to give you kind of a flavor for the caliber of folks on our board.
Why have you gotten so much support from these other people?
Well, we've been fortunate with media coverage, which inspires a good number of thought leaders to check out our website. And when those people do check out our site, I think they are inspired by the classroom projects that they see on our site, and really inspired by the dedication and the imagination and the commitment of the teachers who use our site. Our website is really a showcase of just how innovative and caring our most dedicated teachers are. That commitment and that humanity, I think, inspires a lot of people to want to really get engaged with our organization.
And that's, I mean, it's a model that may well be either scalable or maybe other organizations should be copying you and doing it in other areas too.
I think that's right, and we have a number of peer organizations, one or two of which even started a few months before DonorsChoose.org, which you might also describe as philanthropic marketplaces. Kiva comes immediately to mind, as does Global Giving, and then there are even a couple for-profits such as Kickstarter, which are also based on a kind of a marketplace of good deeds.
Hmm. One of the things with what you're doing helping the teachers out and funding all these projects, it's obviously a good thing to that. But isn't this stuff that state governments should be funding? Like, are we then effectively subsidizing state governments and they can sit back and say, well, we won't bother buying new computers for the classroom because, you know, these donors do guys, they'll just take care of us for us and we'll spend the money on, private planes or something like that.
Yeah, right. You are absolutely right to ask that question. We see the opposite dynamic taking place. Half the project requests on our site go beyond what you expect taxpayer support. A field trip to Washington, D.C. to see the Supreme Court consider a case. A pet hedgehog, therapeutic horseback riding for disabled students, etc. Half the projects on our site do make the reader say, damn, I can't believe there's a classroom that doesn't have dictionaries, or an art teacher who's being asked to teach without fundamental art supplies. And that's exactly the reaction we want to elicit in our website visitors and donors. 60% of our donors say that their experience at donors2.org has made them more interested in systemic reform and more committed to getting government to do a better job. I think the reason is that the donors who come to our site, 70% of them have never before made a donation to public schools. And for them, this is often their first encounter with what's really going on in public schools in low-income communities. And they're having this encounter in a really vivid, personal way. They're not reading a statistic in a newspaper article, which is probably unlikely to get you out of your chair demanding reform. They are connecting to a particular group of students with whom they feel they now have a relationship. They see the personalities of some of those students and the teacher. They think about them when they're going into the voting booth. And far from saying, all right, I just provided the class of dictionaries, so the state government no longer needs to do a better job, they feel like they now have a personal connection to, a responsibility toward, an awareness of this classroom and what's going on in other classrooms in low-income communities, and that energizes them politically and makes them more likely to become civic actors. So actually 22% of our donors said that their experience on our site made them more likely to even vote in an election or in an education budget referendum.
I get what you're saying, but on the other hand, I mean, $20 million in revenue this year, hockey stick growth, so a couple of years you're doing $100 million a year. At that point, I mean, lazy local politicians who are facing budget cuts in different areas, we'll be able to look at it and say, well, you know, let's let that go. Or are you saying that because the constituents then are going to see that where all of these shortfalls are, they might want to be careful with that because then if they do that too much, it's going to get them voted out of office?
That's exactly right. I'll give you one example. In Chicago, a school principal threatened to fire a teacher for putting a project request up on donors2.org. And the reason was that this teacher's project request was, although it was totally positive about the school and the environment, just by virtue of requesting a class out of dictionaries, this teacher was revealing that the school didn't have dictionaries. And that was incredibly embarrassing for the school principal, so much so that he told the teacher to stop using our site at risk of losing her job. I think that donors2.org is a way for teachers to go public with unmet student needs, which more often the school system leaders would rather kind of paper over and hide from public view.
That's really powerful.
We think, you know, fresh air and transparency usually means only good things, and we think this donors2.org will be another example of that.
And so maybe have you thought about this as a goal for the organization? Is to make the organization not relevant, right? So you could
absolutely
say we're done with schools and now we're going on to some other area like police or fire brigade or something like that.
Absolutely, we would love to kind of expose and prod the broader system into putting us out of business, at least on the currently 50% of classroom projects which are for essential material that the system ought to be providing. I think there'd be a continued role for donors2.org in innovation, where a teacher who has a really experimental project idea. A way of teaching that might go beyond the typical curriculum, a field trip that will bring learning to life, and any project which involves resources or ideas that go beyond the standard mandated curriculum, where private philanthropy really is the appropriate way to fund innovation and to experiment. I think there'd be a continued role there, but we'd certainly like to be put out of business on all projects on a site which are for essential resources.
Well, maybe not completely out of business, but at a very low level, and so that it's still there, it's kind of washed up. But
yeah. I think you actually just said it much, much, much better. Yeah, we'll plagiarize your phrasing of it.
that's interesting. Okay, so there's another area I've got to ask is, now you mentioned Kiva, good organization, and I've played around with them a little bit as well, and I'm actually, one of my hobbies is photography, and so I'm actually going to go and do a photo shoot in about 2 weeks of the Kiva donation process from the side in the Dominican Republic.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll be able to post, like, you know, my pictures that are, like, you know, what I'm seeing happening and from my perspective of living here, and so hopefully that can, you know, be interesting for them. I'm actually going to do the same with those shoots. The teacher that I met in New York, I'm going to go and, you know, do that with her as well. So.
That's so cool.
Get some interesting outside perspective photos from an independent guy.
Yeah.
But here in the DR, so Kiva has been doing quite well, but here in the DR there was a fraud of their major local partner. They have two, and this one, the biggest one, now shut down, and they were doing something like $500,000. They've done something like $500,000 in donations, of which that, of something like $250,000 to $300,000 of that has just vanished.
Yeah.
It seems like what happened was that one of the... one of the guys that were running the organization, it was some employees that had somehow managed to steal money. And I don't know what the outcome is, but it's looking like quite a bit of a mess. How do you handle fraught because you're at 20 million an hour, you may well get to 100. That's a lot of money, and I mean the teachers know there's a lot of stuff coming in, and the teachers own the stuff, right? It's not for the schools. It's one of the teachers told me, like, it's my stuff. If I go to another school, I'm taking all these headsets, or I'm taking all these recorders or whatever else that I've been given. I don't think it's a matter of you're not going to have fraud because you're going to have to because you're dealing with a lot of money. How do you deal with that?
There are a couple major measures we take, which we're lucky because we operate in a developed country where the recipients of funding are have internet access and are daily users of email. Because the vendors that we use can correspond with us electronically, we're able to do a whole range of things to guarantee the integrity of the donor beneficiary exchange, which organizations operating in the developing world just can't do. So as one primary example, we took massive temptation for fraud out of the equation by purchasing resources ourselves and fulfilling the actual project and not giving the teacher any cash. That goes a really long way, even eliminating the possibility for fraud because a classroom library, can only be sold for so much on the black market.
It's enough of a lot of value to gain. I mean, lots of electronic equipment and things like that. They have to get the actual stuff rather than cash, but there's eBay and Craigslist and stuff, so you can move things pretty quickly.
Absolutely. And I'll mention a couple other measures that we take. When a project is funded and we proceed to purchase the resources, and of course we have the resources shipped to a school address that has been verified by the federal government, we do not ship. A teacher cannot input an address which they claim is their school, but which might really be their home address, that the resources are shipped to the school. And at the same time that we do that, our system electronically, automatically sends a fax to the school principal, telling them that, congratulating them that their teacher at their school has just been funded and listing the resources that are about to arrive. So now there's one person, the teacher's boss, who's aware of what's arriving and who is likely to check up on proper use of those materials. We also email two or three randomly selected teacher users at that same school, congratulating them on their colleague's success. And, of course, one function that notification performs is that there are two or three peer teachers at the school randomly selected who also know exactly what materials have just been.
Is there anything that I'm going to be able to ask you that you're not going to be able to give me a really good answer for?
No. To your point, we actually had what we thought after 106,000 classroom projects funded on our site, we thought we had a very first instance of fraud. Thankfully, it was in New York City, so head of operations and his colleague, our head of customer service, went out to the school and investigated. And it was a printer and a laptop, which, thanks to our system of emailing two or three randomly selected other teachers at the school, one or two of those teachers sent us an email saying, hey, you had alerted me that my colleague, we'll call him Mr. Smith, had just gotten funding for a laptop. I don't see that laptop in his classroom. I'm giving you a red flag on this. So thanks to that system, we were alerted by the teacher's college. We went and investigated, and it was crystal clear that this was an incredibly dedicated teacher who was simply doing some lesson planning from home and needed to be able to work from home as well as in school. The principal verified this. If anything, the investigation of what seemed like our first instance of fraud illustrated sort of the exception that proves the rule. This clearly was a teacher who had taken the laptop home, but who also was very clearly using it at home to do school work. It was not a teacher who had like a hobby on. When they were printing stuff at home, it was clearly entirely for their lesson plans.
When you start up a new school, how do you get new teachers' emails and presence, principal's contact information, that kind of stuff?
Principals, contact info we have automatically through this database of public schools and contact information verified by the federal government. So no matter what, we are able to send a fax addressed to the school principal alerting them to the resources that have arrived. Teachers' email addresses we don't have naturally, but we do get thanks to teachers registering at donors2.org. So in a huge number of instances, it's not the majority of instances, there is at least one, if not two or three, other donors2.org users at the school, and those are the folks whom we email. You're right, though, that in even a large portion of instances, it's just the principal whose contact information we have, but that's the most important person to alert to incoming materials. And, of course, if ever a teacher doesn't post photographs of a project taking place, we follow up very rigorously. And, of course, it's tough to stage a photo shoot of kids using the materials and tough to persuade kids to all write thank you letters to a donor if the project didn't actually take place.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. Okay, is there anything that we haven't talked about which you want to talk about?
I think we are covering it. Maybe just to tie together both Kiva and donors2.org and to kind of re-illustrate the ability for someone to express a personal passion at our site. I'll share this one final anecdote about what happened when a writer for Fortune magazine was doing a story on Kiva and donors2.org as the two websites which Fortune magazine thought were going to change the face of philanthropy. And this writer, when he and I were done talking, said that his personal passion was saving a salmon in Pacific Northwest. And and that was what he cared about, and it was therefore, you know, maybe unlikely that he'd be giving a lot of money at DonorsChoose.org, because education wasn't his passion as much as saving the salmon. And before he left the room, just for the heck of it, I did a keyword search for salmon on DonorsChoose.org, and up came 5 classroom project requests, all relating to salmon in the Northwest. The second result was an Oregon high school teacher who had created a salmon hatchery in the river flowing by his school, and he needed hip waders for his students to go in the river and maintain the hatchery. And the top result was a teacher on an island off of Alaska teaching in a one-room schoolhouse whose students are Native Alaskans and who had recorded their parents' folktales about salmon and done research on salmon, and to share that work with the outside world, they needed a printer and a scanner. So this writer, who had initially thought that DonorsChoose.org wouldn't be his personal passion, realized that, you know, his cause of saving the salmon in the Pacific Northwest absolutely could be expressed through our platform. I think he wound up donating to the Oregon High School Teachers Salmon Project. So anyway, that's
just... Yeah, it'd be easy for him to donate to, like, Dominican kids or...
Oh, my gosh. If you type in keyword Dominican, I'd be excited to see all the matches you'll get from teachers whose students are primarily from the Dominican Republic and probably even some projects that focus on teaching the culture or history of the Dominican Republic.
Oh, wow. That's a look. That's impressive.
Oh, well, it's a testament to the dedication of the teachers who use our site.
Well, I might go make a better donation. Cool. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I think. Oh, sorry. One last thing. Yes. Given the members of your audience who are affiliate marketers, DonorsChoose.org is set up as we're instrumented in Commission Junction as a potential affiliate partner. So if a third-party site wants to drive traffic to our site, and this could just be a general shout-out promotion of DonorsChoose.org, or it could be a really smart one using our API, where a website all about yoga might want to create a little widget pulling in classroom project requests that center on yoga, or you know, you get the idea that using our API, a third-party site can feature classroom product requests fitting any set of criteria. And if actual donations are generated from that third-party website's promotion of DonorsChoose.org or featuring of individual classroom product requests on our site, we're able to make an affiliate or a referral payment to that third-party site. We do it out of our operating budget, not out of the actual donations that are generated. We're able to do 4% cash or 10% DonorsChoose.org dollars if there's an affiliate partner who wants to get their compensation in the form of philanthropic dollars. So hopefully that'll be some food for thought for some of your audience members.
You're a little bit too slick for me, my friend.
No.
You have everything worked out here.
We are making a lot of mistakes and learning as we go.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're talking to, like, probably the biggest Facebook marketers you can reach. So guys, do you have a webpage where they can explain to them about different options and they can get tracking links and sign up?
Yeah, totally.
Do you have, like, extra material and things you give them?
Absolutely. One place to start is for our affiliate partners looking to do something really creative to actually show. Basically, we'd love to see someone create Google AdSense from DonorsChoose.org projects. In other words, targeting classroom project requests in the ad real estate area, which are topically and geographically targeted to the content on the page. And we just think that there's so much affiliate potential there that right now is really untapped. And so for any folks who want to kind of explore the possibilities, DonorsChoose.org/API will give someone the tools they need to pull out classroom project requests from our site onto a third-party site. And CJ, as you mentioned, is the place to apply to be an affiliate partner and to get instrumented and set up. And then, of course, just reaching out to us, and we would be really excited to this is an experimental program for us, and we are happy to invest some face-to-face, you know, hand-holding time in helping to get any, you know, promising affiliate partners set up best of time.
And so what you're offering here is a chance for a guy to drive traffic to and do some like social good, but at the same time they can make a ton of money.
That's exactly right.
All right, so have fun with that, guys. I think you'll probably get a couple of tickets.
I hope so.
All right, is there anything else?
No, this was just really a fantastic set of questions, and it was just awesome. I really, thank you, Adrian. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Take care.